is a representation of some function f of x, okay? But you cannot say that it's equal to the function because this doesn't exist and this does exist. Okay, so at the best thing you can say, and we're going to say something about that, I think, later on in the week, is that this is an asymptotic series representation of this function. But it is not convergent. Okay? So this sign is a generalization of that sign. Okay? Now, we are looking for a different representation of this function that might converge. And the ingenious idea, not at all mine, I mean, mine was just the way of explaining it through a set of orthogonal polynomials, was to reconstruct this object as a different object which might converge. And that object had the form b0 over 1 minus b1x over 1 minus b2x, and so on. And this continued fraction can only be understood as a sequence of approximants. Okay, so if I say to you, what does this mean? The answer can only be, it means construct a sequence of objects. The first one is b0. The second one is b0 over 1 minus b1x. And the next one is b0 over 1 minus b1x over 1 minus b2x, and so on. So this is a sequence of objects. Okay. Now you plug in the value of x that you happen to be interested in. Okay, so this gives you a sequence. This is the zeroth term in the sequence, the first term, the second term, and so on. And this is called the continued fraction sequence. And this sequence typically converges, even though this series does not converge. Why is that? Because this series diverges as soon as it sees a singularity. But this sequence has singularities built into it. In the denominator, zeros in the denominator. So because this sequence has singularities, it has a better chance of existing and converging. Okay, that's the idea. But it doesn't have to be a continued fraction. It could be a continued function. And there are so many different continued functions you could play with that this is like, you know, if you're interested in this is like a candy shop for a baby, right? You walk in and there's so many functions that you could study and play with and examine and so on. So it's huge. It's very, very interesting. Okay. So let's see. Before we talk about the mathematical properties of continued fractions and Pauli approximants and what is known rigorously, I wanted to show you something. I wanted to discuss another way of obtaining divergent series. And this is very relevant to what you've been studying, because you've had at least one, probably several courses involving quantum field theory, right? Two courses, okay? And Feynman diagrams are the way of understanding a quantum field theory. And what bothers me about Feynman diagrams, or at least the way I was taught Feynman diagrams, is that they're so complicated. And it has to do, there's all kinds of Wick products and contractions and whatnot. It's horrible. It's just horrible. And Feynman diagrams are beautiful and simple and really easy to understand. And I thought I would explain it sort of my way. You can like it or not like it, but I think Feynman diagrams are really interesting, and they're especially interesting to us as theoretical physicists because they're basically the only way to crack into a field theory, to understand quantum field theory and quantum mechanics, by the way, not just quantum field theory. So what's a Feynman diagram? So it's very simple. A Feynman diagram is nothing but a bunch of dots and lines. That's it. Okay? So how do you make a Feynman diagram? You draw a bunch of dots. Okay, and these dots are called vertices. Okay. And each vertex has, you can think of a vertex as, I mean, this is a very artistic sort of thing. Each vertex has a bunch of connection points, okay, as many as you want, okay? So it could be that these vertices here have three connection points, okay? So I drew these as little dotted things, okay, because they're not there yet, okay? They're just potential places where you can connect lines. So in addition to the vertices, we have lines, okay? And so your objective is to simply connect up the dots with lines. That's it. Okay? So, for example, I can draw a line. I can use one of these connection points and one of these connection points and draw a line over here. Okay? I still have two more connection points here, two more here, three here, right? And I could draw a line here, and I could draw a line here. Okay? And now I still have three connection points, one here, one here, one here, remaining, okay? And we could either have lines coming in from infinity and connecting to these points, right? Or we could have, you know, if I only allow two lines coming in from infinity, I can't finish this graph. So this is an impossible graph. Okay, because there's one more connection point remaining. And if I can't connect it to infinity, then I'm done. I can't draw a graph. This was an impossible problem. Okay? However, it could be that these vertices have three connection points. This is a three vertex. This is a three vertex. Okay? But it could be that this is a four vertex. Okay? You can have some specified number of lines. So there are two connection points here. And now I can finish the graph because I can do this. Okay? So now I have a line going out and coming back in. And now I have completed my graph. Okay? So you should think of a graph as a pot of spaghetti in which the ends of the spaghettis are attached to points. That's it. That's what a graph is. Okay? It's that simple. Okay. Now, in fact, it's very interesting. Vertices and lines are actually the same thing, topologically speaking. Okay, they can be dual to one another. In other words, the lines that I was drawing here are simple lines, lines that have two ends that we can attach to vertices. But you don't have to have that. You can have more complicated lines. You could have a line having three ends. Why not? Okay, we could call it a tripus, you know. If it had eight ends, we call it an octopus. Okay? So you can imagine that there's a head over here, and this line has three legs. And those legs could be attached to vertices. So you can see that there's a duality between lines and dots. Dots are what you attach the legs of the lines to, okay? And this is some animal that has a head and three lines, or it could be an animal that has a head and four lines, if you want to be fancy. Usually, in quantum field theory, we're only talking about lines that have two ends, but the line could have five ends, okay? And vertices, you could have vertices of as many types as you like, okay? That's what a graph is. And the main thing to remember is that a graph, or Feynman diagram, if this is a Feynman diagram or a Feynman graph, a graph is only a topological object that says how dots are connected to one another by lines. Okay? You don't have to think of the lines as, you know, this line, for example, could cross over and cross back again. That is, where it's located in space doesn't matter. It doesn't make the least bit of difference. Okay? The only important thing here is that we have a line going from here that eventually connects to here. Okay? and the fact that it crosses this line is irrelevant. It's only the connectedness of the lines that makes any difference to us at all. Okay. And by the way, you can represent a graph. So for the most, to begin with, let's consider the simplest possible case where we don't have any lines going off to infinity. So to begin with, let's forget the possibility of having lines that run off to infinity. Again, those are external lines. But let's just consider the possibility of connecting up dots with lines and completely connecting them up without any lines running off to infinity. Those are called, in quantum field theory, those are called, do you know what they're called? Anybody have any idea? They're called bubbles or vacuum bubbles. Okay, you've heard the word. Okay, now, so if we had, for example, if we had four vertices, that is, vertices where you could attach, say, just four lines coming in to every vertex. And if you had two lines, that is, lines having two legs, two endpoints, so ordinary lines that look like this, okay, then if you started to draw the graphs, usually we let n be the number of vertices. Number of vertices is n. Usually we number the number of vertices, but not always. You don't always have to do that. Okay. So if we were to start drawing graphs, let's draw all the graphs having one vertex. Okay. Well, if you want to draw a graph having one vertex, this vertex has four connections. So if you were to draw all the graphs, it would look like this. Okay, so it looks like an infinity. Okay. And for n equals 2, can you tell me what the graphs would look like? Yeah. How would you draw them? Very good. Okay, so that's a Mickey Mouse hat or something like that. Okay, that's one graph. Anything else? Disconnected. Okay, that's right. So we haven't used the word connected or disconnected yet, so let's introduce that. There is a disconnected graph where there is no continuous path from one vertex to any other vertex in the graph. So the idea would be you would have something like this. Okay? That's a disconnected graph. Yeah?
Can I stand a little more over there when you're writing
it? All right. This is a left-handed lecture. Okay. So, all right. Yeah? That's right. We can have two vertices like that. Okay? And that's all the graphs. Okay. Now, the most important, so let's see, before we go on, it doesn't matter how you draw this picture. And it may be convenient to draw this picture one way or another way. Maybe, for example, this in this graph, it might help you, it might, I don't think it would, but it might help you to think of it as a pair of lines, maybe, and another pair of lines. But this is the same graph. Okay, because the only thing that matters is the topology of the connectedness. And by the way, to describe a graph, you can, we're not going to persist with this, but there's lots of interesting stuff you can do because you can represent a graph as a connectivity matrix. Okay, so for example, here's 1, 2, 1, 2. Okay, so take this graph, for example. To represent this as a matrix, I would say, look, here's vertex number 1, and here's vertex number 2. And you notice there are two lines going from vertex 1 to vertex 2. So from 1 to 2, you see in that spot, I would write a 2, saying that there are two connections. Okay? And of course, by symmetry, there are two connections from vertex 2 to vertex 1. Okay? And furthermore, there's two, you notice there are two ways to go from 2 to 2. 2 is connected from 2 to 2, two ways. So I could put a 2 here and a 2 here. Connect 1 is connected to 1. Two ways, okay, that, and 2 is connected to 2. Two ways. Okay. So here is a matrix, and if I just gave you this matrix, you could immediately draw the graph. Okay? And for example, this graph would have the matrix, this 1 is connected to 2 4 times, and 2 is connected to 1 4 times, and we would have that matrix. Okay? And so all I need to do is to give you a connectivity matrix, and you would be able to draw the graph. Okay? And where the lines go doesn't matter. The only thing is the connectivity. Okay? This has to be, by the way, a symmetric matrix. And you notice that if I sum across the rows or sum across the columns, I must get a total which is consistent with the graph. Right? There are altogether 4 here. 4 here, 4 here, 4 here. If I sum here, I get 4, 4, 4, 4. Okay? So, there's one subtlety. I won't talk anymore about matrices. But there's one subtlety that you have to understand when you draw a graph. And that is, it's very hard. That's the one hard thing to understand about graphs. It is the symmetry number of a graph. Okay. Okay. And roughly speaking, the symmetry number of a graph is the number of ways that you can turn the graph into itself by permuting vertices or by permuting lines. And this is the only way I can explain this to you is, rather than giving you mathematical theorems or something like that, is to just do a bunch of examples, and eventually you'll see the idea. Okay. So for example, this graph. Now, the symmetry number is 1 over the number of ways of permuting the graph geometrically into itself. Okay. So for example, for this graph, what is the symmetry number for that graph? So let me show you how you argue it. You see this ear sticking out of the graph. Okay. What I can do is take that ear and interchange it with itself. I can flip this ear. Okay. Just turn over the ear like that. Okay. So instead of coming out of here and going in here, I'm coming out of here and going in here. Okay. So I get 2 points for that, because I have just a reflection symmetry. And independent of that, I can flip this ear. Okay, and independent of that, I have one more symmetry. Do you see what it is? Yeah. You can interchange the two ears. Okay. So without doing any harm to the connectivity of the graph, without changing that connectivity matrix, in other words, I can interchange these two ears. And that's a reflection symmetry as well. So the total symmetry is 2 times 2 times 2, which is 1/8. And that's the symmetry of that graph. Okay? Now, can anybody tell, let's just do, we have to do a bunch of examples. Probably we should do a dozen examples, just so we see what's going on. How about this graph? Okay, this one that we drew over here. What is the symmetry of this graph? Now think about it for a while. Okay. Does anybody think they know the symmetry number? 16. Say it again?
16.
16, absolutely. Okay, very good. Why is it 16? Because for flipping this ear, you get 2. For flipping this ear, you get 2. For interchanging these two lines, you get 2. Okay, leaving the graph invariant. Okay. And finally, for interchanging these two vertices, you get 2. And those are all independent symmetries. Okay, so you get 2 more, 2 times 2 times 2, 1/16. Okay, very good. Okay, do you all see that so far? Okay, what about this graph? This is a four-legged octopus doing push-ups in front of a mirror. Okay. So what is the symmetry of that? What is that? Nope. You're getting closer. I didn't hear the number yet. Yeah.
4 factorial from the lines times 2.
Very good. Very, very, very good. Okay. So the product is 1 over 48. Very good. Okay. So again, what is the symmetry? All these lines are identical lines. So we can permute them among themselves. So there's 4 factorial ways of permuting those lines. Okay. And then there's an additional factor of 2 from interchanging the 2 vertices, which don't do any, that they don't have any effect on the lines themselves. We can just turn the graph around. So the symmetry number of that is 1 over 48. Okay. Are you beginning to get the picture? I mean, this is not impossibly difficult, but it can be tricky. So what do I mean by that? So for example, how about this graph? What is the symmetry of that graph? Say again? Nope.
3.
Not that big.
3. 6.
Well, someone said 6. That's right. 6. So there are 2 symmetries of this graph. Okay. The first symmetry is that I can rotate this graph into 3 positions. That was the 3 that you were talking about. So you saw that I could rotate 3 ways. I have a 3-fold symmetry. So I certainly have a factor of 3. Okay. Now, I don't, if there's more symmetry to that graph, but I don't want to get confused. So to avoid using that rotational symmetry, I'm going to take a hammer and a nail, nail this vertex down into the board so that I can no longer rotate the graph around itself. This is nailed down. But now you see, if I'm holding this thing down, there is still more symmetry. And the symmetry is that I can interchange these 2 vertices. And that has nothing to do, that's an independent symmetry, independent of rotating the graph around, right? So I get 3 times 2, so that symmetry is 6. Yeah?
Can you just view it as permuting the 3 vertices?
Well, you have to be careful, because, well, to answer your question, let's do another example, and you'll see. Of course, this looks like 3 factorial, okay, but in this case, it is 3 factorial, but how about this graph? Okay, there are 4 vertices in that graph. Each of the vertices is a 2 vertex, okay, and there are 4 lines. Each of the lines is a 2-ended line, okay. How do you, what is the symmetry? Or let me ask you, since we just had that discussion, if you had to find the symmetries of that graph, what would you do? Let's try the same sort of argument.
Well, you can rotate it in 4 positions, but you can also flip it in.
Okay, so wait. So we can, so you are correct that you could rotate this graph around into 4 positions. Okay? So we have a 4-fold symmetry there. Okay, but now I don't want to use that symmetry anymore, so I'm going to nail one of these legs to the floor. Okay, you can't rotate it anymore. Okay, now I still see a symmetry. How much symmetry is left in that graph? 2, that's right. Not 4, but 2. So you're right, it's 2, because I could interchange these 2 legs. That's the only symmetry that's left. Okay, so I get 2 more, I get a reflection of this point and this point, and that's it. That's the end of the symmetry, so the symmetry number would be 1/8. So although this looks like it might have been 3 factorial, this is not 4 factorial. Okay. And in fact, we can continue that. If I had a pentagon like this, so I had five vertices, again, what would the symmetry number be? Just using the same argument. Say it again?
10.
So the symmetry number is 1/10 by exactly the same argument. So I can rotate this into five positions. And after I'm done rotating it, I'm going to nail one of the vertices to the floor. And then I see what other symmetry is left. And I notice that I can interchange this and this, but also this and this at the same time. Otherwise, I would twist the graph and destroy the graph, okay, tear it apart. So I have to interchange the entire graph so that the symmetry of a pentagon is 1/10. Okay, are you getting it? Yeah.
So why do we do it only with one vertex in one vertex?
Oh, with nailing a vertex to the floor.
Yeah, only one.
Oh, we... You know, that I just want to avoid a rotation. Okay, so that's the minimal thing I can do to avoid rotating.
No, what I'm saying is that why don't I then nail another vertex and do the same? Then
flip and continue this process.
Yeah.
Sure. Oh, yeah. So let's, okay, let me do an example. Okay, let's do an example of that. Suppose I gave you this graph. Four vertices. Here's four vertices, okay? And then a line like this and a line like that. Okay, so this would be an example which would be relevant. So this is a graph with four vertices. Each vertex has three lines coming out of it, okay? And it is not at all obvious what the symmetry of this graph is. This is hard.
This is really quite hard. Can anybody see what the symmetry of that graph should be? Extremely good. How did you get it so fast? That's hard.
Because everything is connected to everything.
That's right. That's right. But now let me make the argument the way Tibor wanted was saying. But you're absolutely right. It's 24. Okay. And let's see if. The way I would argue it, just sort of intuitively, is I would say, I'm going to redraw this graph. Okay? It's hard to look at a cross box like this. Okay? So if you just think of what the connectivity is, this is really a tetrahedron. Can you see that? Can you see that this graph, if I redraw it without changing the connectivity, I can think of it as three of the vertices as forming a triangle, and the fourth vertex up here, okay, connected to all three of those graphs. So can you see this as a pyramid with a triangular base? This is exactly the same as that. Okay, so here is the triangular base, for example, and that's the top of the pyramid. Now, if I think of it this way, okay, let's begin with this graph. This graph can be rotated around. I can rotate this graph around without changing anything, okay, four ways. Okay, so that's four. That gives me a factor of four. Okay, now I don't want to rotate this around, so I'm going to nail one of those vertices to the floor. Okay, now I have nailed that to the floor, so we can no longer rotate them around. But you can think of this as a triangle dangling down from a point up here. Now, do you all see that this little triangle here can be rotated around without changing the graph? And I can rotate it around three ways. Okay, but now I don't want to rotate it anymore, so I'm going to nail that point to the floor. So I'm nailing subsequent points to the floor. Okay, and I still have a symmetry. Okay, and the symmetry is that I could still interchange those two vertices. Now you have to do this in your head. Okay, you could still interchange those two vertices. Okay, and leave the graph invariant, which gives me a factor of two. And of course, that's what you saw right away, that this has 4 factorial symmetry. Okay, so the answer, symmetry number here is 1 over 24. Okay, so how about one more? Let's do one more, and a hard one. Do a hard one, say.
Sure.
So, in fact, you can certainly generalize that. So if we had, say, 5 vertices, and each of those vertices had 4 lines coming out of them, connecting to, you know, the other 4 vertices, then indeed you would have 5 factorial, the symmetry would be 1 over 120. Okay. But here's one where we don't have all of the vertices connected to all. Suppose we do, let's see, how about this one? Okay, take a hexagon, and let's connect these 3 lines, these 3 vertices together, okay? And let's connect these. To each other. So this is a Jewish star, right? Okay. So you see, I'm avoiding. I could take 6 vertices. And connect all the vertices to all the other vertices. Then we know the answer would be as symmetric as it could possibly be. The symmetry would be 6 factorial. But here, we're not doing that. Okay. So there are still 4 lines coming out of every vertex. I can see you've got it. You're almost there, or maybe you even have the answer. What do you think it is?
Six from here.
Almost. You almost have it. Okay. So here's what I mean, there are many ways of arguing this, and everybody has different ways of looking, you know, artistically at a graph, you know, perceiving it in their mind. But this is how I would argue it. I would say, look, this graph can be rotated into 6 positions. Okay, so surely there's a symmetry of 6, a rotational symmetry of 6. Okay, now, I don't want to rotate it anymore, so I'm going to nail this vertex into the floor. But you, using your fingers, I saw that you visualized what happened. If you nail that into the floor, let me think of it as hanging this from the ceiling like a chandelier. Okay, then I have a vertex up here nailed to the ceiling now, actually, not the floor. Okay. And there are 4 lines coming out, and they are connected to a square. Okay. Can you see that? From this, there are 4 lines going out. Boom, 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 boom. And they're connected to this square here in the middle. Okay, so this is a square. Okay. And then from the square, there are 4 more lines coming out, boom, 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 to a vertex on the bottom. Now, you see that square? I can rotate that square around. I have a chandelier that's dangling from the ceiling. I can rotate that square into 4 positions. You see that? So 6 times 4. Now I don't want to rotate that anymore, so I'll nail that to something. But there's still a tiny bit more symmetry. Do you see what it is? It's a 2. It's a 2 symmetry. So we have to go to, let's see, to this line here, I guess. Okay. And we can flip this line without changing anything else. Okay. And that gives us 6 times 4 times 2. So the symmetry of the graph is 1 over 48. Okay? Yeah. So let's find the other two. So I want to find a line that is as far from this and as far from this as possible. There's a unique one. It's actually not that. It's this one right here. Yeah, that line. Okay, if I take this line here and interchange it, you see that? I don't change the graph. So I can interchange that vertex there and that vertex there without doing anything to the graph, without harming it in any way. So you see what graph this is? This is an octahedron. Okay? Yeah.
Could you do the same thing with the line in the back?
No, because once I flip this, then I have to hire, you know, a bouncer or something like that who reaches out and grabs this line and doesn't let that line move anymore. And now you can't flip any other lines. You would tear this line apart if you tried to flip something else afterward. Okay? Okay, so this is hard sometimes to visualize it. But generally, when you're doing quantum field theory, here's the bad news is this could get complicated, right? If I drew a graph having 16 lines in it, you might find the symmetry number hard to perceive. But the good news is that in real life, what's the chance that you're ever going to be asked to evaluate a graph with 16 lines? It's hopeless. It's completely hopeless because quantum field theory is so complicated that at best, if you were going to try to evaluate a graph like that, you just feed it into a computer. You would not ask a human being to do this unless they were, they had a life sentence in a prison somewhere or something like that. Okay, so now we get to the interesting part. Okay, so do you have a sort of feeling about, we're going to go back to this, spiral learning. We'll go back to this and we'll evaluate some more symmetry numbers, but yeah.
So this question is a little bit tangential, so feel free not to answer it, but can we use quantum field theory, a pared down quantum field theory to solve problems in graph theory by using physical ideas?
Yes, as a way of counting graphs, absolutely. So a simplified quantum field theory is a way of counting graphs. And indeed, we'll do that. We'll do that. That's interesting. We'll do that. Okay. So why do we do this? Because in quantum field theory, we think of a graph as representing a number. So when you have a graph in a quantum field theory, we have to evaluate this graph as a number. Okay? And the way we evaluate a given graph is extremely simple. The graph, the numerical value of, so until now, a graph has only been a picture for us, okay, just a connectivity picture. But in quantum field theory, you assign a number to a graph. So for a given graph, how do you assign the number? It's really simple. The numerical value of a graph is defined as the symmetry number of the graph multiplied by what is called the vertex amplitudes, okay, and multiplied by the line amplitudes, okay. So for our simple graphs that we're talking about right now, when I say that you have, say, a four vertex, okay, I give you a number for that four vertex. I'm going to show you where that number comes from, but just think of it as a number, and we're going to call that number V4. Okay, so there's an and this is called the vertex amplitude. And if we have a two line, that is a simple line having two ends, we're going to give that a number called an amplitude, and we'll call that L2, a line having two ends. Okay, so here's an example. Suppose we had this graph to evaluate. Okay, you notice that there are these lines are two lines. Each of these lines has two ends. Okay, so this is a two line. Each of these vertices have four connection points. So there's a V4 over here and another V4 over there. And we agreed that the symmetry number for this graph is 1 over 48. That's the symmetry number. So what's the value of this graph? It is equal to 1 over 48 times L2 to the fourth, because there are four lines, times V4 squared. And that is the number of the graph. I mean, that's the value of the graph. It's just that simple. OK? Now, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to give you one theorem, which I'm not going to prove to you, but I'm just going to simply state it. Okay? And it is a theorem from graph theory. It's very simple to understand. And it just gives you the relationship. It tells you how to construct. It tells you the result of constructing all possible graphs. Okay? So these are individual graphs. Now, here is the theorem. Suppose I gave you that object, e to the d by dx. Can you tell me what that means? If you had to make sense out of that, how would you define e to the d by dx? Say it again? A Taylor series. That's right. You know, this is a funny thing. It's the exponential of a derivative operator. But we can make perfect sense out of it, because this is just 1 plus d by dx plus d squared dx squared over 2 plus and so on. So if I write an exponential of a derivative operator, it makes perfect sense, right? Yeah. Is the derivative? Yeah, that's right. And we're not going to worry about this at all. You're absolutely right. And who cares? Let me tell you why. What you said is actually very subtle, because since it's an unbounded operator, if I allow this to operate on certain things, I'm typically going to end up with a divergent series. And this doesn't surprise us in the least, because we expect to get divergent series. Okay? That's the point of it being a bounded or an unbounded operator. So what you said is actually very relevant and very interesting. And it's the origin of the divergent series that occur in quantum field theory. Okay? So here's the theorem. Suppose we were to write down E to the sum from n equals 1 to infinity of L sub n over 2 over n factorial times d by dx to the n. Okay? And we let that operate on E to the sum from m equals 1 to infinity of v sub m over m factorial x to the m. Okay, so this is very complicated. Okay, so what do we mean by this? Well, you can expand this out into a series, into a Taylor series, right? And then you could expand this out into a gigantic Taylor series, not worrying about whether these series converge or diverge. We're not going to be concerned about that. And now you can let all those derivatives with respect to x act on all those powers of x. What a mess. Okay, this is a mess. Okay? But when we get done, we're going to set x equal to 0. Okay? What do you get? You get the sum of all graphs, okay, plus 1. Okay, you see where the 1 comes from. The first term in this series, when you expand it out, is 1. Okay, and the sum of all the terms in this series, when you expand it out, is 1. So there's always going to be a 1 times a 1. That's the 1. So you get 1 plus the sum of all the graphs evaluated according to these rules. That is, where each of the graphs, when I say the sum of all the graphs, I mean the sum of all the numerical values of those graphs. That's what you get. Okay? Yeah.
When you say all graphs, which graphs?
All of the graphs that you can construct using those types of lines and those types of vertices, all of them, the whole set. So this is an enormous number of junk. Okay, this is huge. Okay? That's the statement. Okay? Yeah. Yes. So you're allowed. So what's an example of a graph here? In general, there's we're summing over all possible vertices and all possible lines. Okay? And there's a 3 vertex, there's a 7 vertex, so for example, there would be, say, a V4 in here, in principle. Okay? Of course, in our case, almost everything here is going to be 0. And almost everything here is going to be 0. In fact, typically, there's only going to be one term in this and only one term in this, typically, in quantum field theory. Okay? But for now, this is the completely general theorem. Okay? But for example, there is, in principle, a V4. And in principle, there's an L4, a line with 4 ends. So what's an example of a graph that I can make out of V4 and L4? It would be a graph that looks like this. There's one vertex, V4, which has 4 connection points, and one quadrupus, okay, one line having 4 ends, okay, and I'm going to connect those 4 ends. So this thing is an L4 here, and there is such a graph. Okay, and the symmetry number of this graph would be now what? No, not 1 over 48. Not for this graph. Because a V4 and an L4 are different. 1 over 24. So the lines are all symmetric. So the symmetry number would be 1 over 24. And in this expansion, if I expand this exponential and expand this exponential, multiply it all out, take the derivative with respect to x, that's a term that we're going to find there. Now, I want to show you how this works. I'm going to show you how it works. But do you all understand what we've said here? Yeah, you have a question.
I don't understand why each of the lines has 4 ends.
Why not? I mean, this is a line. This thing is a line having 2 ends, right? So I can think of this as a little head over here. So this is a little guy over here. And this guy has 2 legs. And you could attach one leg to one vertex and one leg to another vertex, or maybe to the same vertex. Okay. Now here's another guy. Okay. And this guy happens to have 4 legs, or 3 legs.
No.
That's a line with 3 ends. So this would be an L3.
But why do we still call it a line?
Why not? Because it has legs. Okay, a vertex doesn't have any legs. A vertex is just a dot with little connection points where you can attach legs. Okay, but a line is something whose legs stick out, if you like. Of course, you understand that this and this have the same topology, and therefore you can see almost immediately that I could rewrite this. I could rewrite this immediately as e to the sum from m equals 1 to infinity, 1 over m factorial vm d by dx to the m. Okay, and I could attach these legs, now I'll call them legs, to these vertices. And I would get exactly the same answer at x equals 0. Okay? But now you know everything about graphs. That's the amazing thing. That's the end of the lecture on Feynman graphs. I want to show you how to use them. But this is it. That's all there is. This is the key theorem about graphs. Okay? But I want to show you how we use such a theorem. Okay? So
Question? Square? Yeah. I'm sorry. I didn't see.
No,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Doesn't this thing if you have like L2 to the 4 and V4 to the 2 or something like that, mm-hmm. then if you like have one coefficient for that one term, but
yes.
that one term has like many kind of graphs. So yeah, that's grouping all the graphs.
Yes, it's summing them all together. So this is the sum. This is the sum of all possible graphs.
So it doesn't differentiate like two different kinds of graphs.
That's right. That's right. It doesn't. Not yet. So we need to find a way to differentiate between different graphs. And we're going to do that. We're going to see where that comes from. Okay? So but this is the generic theorem. Okay, so whenever you have an exponential of a derivative operator, operating on the exponential of a function, in general, what I'm saying to you is if we had something to perform e to some function of d by dx, operating on e to another function of x, okay, and evaluated at x equals 0, this is equal to the sum, 1 plus, the sum of all graphs. And that's just a topological theorem. Okay? So I want to show you where this comes from. I don't mean where it comes from, but how we actually make use of this, because this is really wild. I mean, I claim this is the sum of all graphs with each graph multiplied by its appropriate symmetry number. So let's see where, you know, why is, the question is, why is this useful to us? Now, do you remember, I think last Friday, I gave you an example of a simple quantum field theory, very, very simple quantum field theory. So I said, consider the integral from 0 to infinity of the square root of 2 over pi e to the minus x squared over 2 minus epsilon x to the fourth over 4. Okay, remember that? And I said, take, this is a 4 here, okay? And I said, take this, suppose we need to evaluate that integral. So you can either think of this as a very, very simple example of a quantum field theory, or if you don't like quantum field theory, it's a freshman calculus integral. So someone walks up to you and says, evaluate the integral. And you say, or they say maybe, or did we put in a 4? I don't think we put in a 4. Never mind. Let's not put in a 4. Let's leave off the 4. So somebody walks up to you on the street and says to you, can you evaluate that integral? And you say, I don't know how to do that in terms of elementary functions, so I'm going to use perturbation theory. Okay? And you put in an epsilon over here. Okay? Remember? And what did we then do? We said, to evaluate this guy, we would expand this part of the integrand as a series in powers of epsilon. Okay? So this is an integral from 0 to infinity dx, e to the minus x squared over 2, times 1 minus epsilon x to the 4 plus epsilon squared x to the 8th over 2 factorial, and so on. Okay? And then we would integrate this term by term. Okay? And the first integral gives us just this piece right here, 1 times e to the minus x squared over 2. That gives us 1. Okay, and you remember the next thing gives us minus epsilon. And then the integral of x to the 4 times e to the minus x squared over 2 is just 3 double factorial. So it gives us 3 epsilon, just 3. Okay, and the next term would give us plus epsilon squared over 2, okay, times the integral of x to the 8th, which is 7, that is
7 double factorial, which is 7 times 5 times 3. What is 7 times 5 times 3? It's 105, right? So this is a 105, and so on. Okay, now, suppose you're a field theorist, however. So you've got a perturbation series. You can see that the coefficients in this perturbation series are getting very big. This is a divergent series. Okay, this doesn't surprise us at all. But suppose you're a quantum field theorist. Okay, so what do you do? So you do something fancy. You say, take this integral here. Let's call this I. You say, I'm going to write I as the square root of 2 over pi times the integral from 0 to infinity, square root of, oh, I wrote that already, dx times e to the minus x squared over 2 times e to the minus epsilon x to the fourth. And now just for laughs, just for fun, let me put in a factor of 1 into this, which is e to the j times x. In quantum field theory, j represents an external source. Have you used that term? You have. Good. OK. So of course, I've changed the integral unless I set j equal to 0. But now I haven't done anything yet. Okay. But you notice that if I differentiate with respect to j, if I take d by dj, d by dj of e to the jx, I get x if I set j equal to 0. And if I differentiate d by dj squared times e to the jx at j equals 0, I get x squared. You see that? So in fact, if I had any function of d by dj operating on e to the jx and I evaluated at j equals 0, I get that function of x. Do you all agree? Great. Well, what's the difficult thing about this integral here? The thing that makes this integral very difficult to evaluate is that exponential of a quartic. So I can rewrite this thing here as e to the minus epsilon d by dj to the fourth power on e to the jx, because I'm evaluating it at j equals 0. But this is cool, because you notice this doesn't depend on x. And since it doesn't depend on x, I can pull it out of the integral. So I can rewrite this as the square root of 2 over pi e to the minus epsilon d by dj to the fourth power. Okay, operating on the integral from 0 to infinity dx e to the minus x squared over 2 times e to the jx. Of course, at the end, I have to set j equal to 0. Aha. But this is a Gaussian integral. Isn't that cool? And I can evaluate a Gaussian integral. Okay, how do I evaluate this integral? What do I do? Complete the square. I'm
just looking for the term. Complete the square. Okay, so this is e to the minus 1/2 x squared minus 2jx.
Okay, so in order to complete the square, I add j squared and I subtract j squared. Okay, so that gives me the square root of 2 over pi e to the minus epsilon d by dj to the fourth power. OK. Now, you notice that I have an e to the minus 1 half times minus j squared, which is e to the j squared over 2. And what is left over is this Gaussian integral, which I evaluate just by shifting x. And that Gaussian integral from 0 to infinity gives me the square root of pi over 2. So this is the square root of pi over 2 goes away. And this is what I've ended up with. And of course, this has to be evaluated at j equals 0. OK. Did you follow what I did? Yeah, you have a question.
In shifting x, do you have a problem turning into 0?
In shifting, yes. And in fact, I do. However, this is even. This is an even integral. So in fact, what I can do is write it as, you're absolutely right. So I write this as 1 half times the integral from minus infinity to infinity. And go all the way down. OK, 1 half minus infinity to infinity, 1 half minus infinity to infinity. And now the 1 half goes away. OK, so that's automatic. OK? So now look at this structure here. That structure has a graphical interpretation. Now, which is simpler for you? I can tell you what's simpler for me to think about, but I could ask you as a class. Is it easier for you to think about vertices having 4 connection points and lines having 2 ends? Or would you rather think about lines having 4 connection points and vertices having 2 ends? Now, frankly, I like to think of vertices connected up with ordinary two-ended lines. Okay? But this is a matter of your personal taste. I mean, this has to do with your artistic talent or something like this. But I'm going to interpret this as a line, and as a line L2, and I know what the amplitude of the line is. What is the amplitude of the line? From the theorem that I carefully erased from the blackboard. So what's L2 equal to? I look at this picture from that theorem I gave you. What do I write down for a line? Say it again.
1.
That's right. Just 1. Okay? Because there's a 2 factorial here. Okay? Now, this I'm supposed to interpret as a 4 vertex. Right? And the question here is, what is the amplitude of that 4 vertex? Remember the theorem. The theorem requires that there be a 4 factorial in the denominator, right? So if I put in a 1 over 4 factorial, if I divide by it, I have to put it back over here. I have to put 4 factorial there. So what is the amplitude for a 4 vertex? Minus
4 times epsilon.
And the epsilon is up here, right? So the 4 vertex would be minus 24 epsilon. That's the 4 vertex. Aha! Now I claim that if I need to evaluate this, I will sum over all the graphs that I can construct plus 1. Okay. Now, look here. Here is the 1. That's the plus 1. Okay. So let's first construct. But you notice this is organized for me. You notice that this 4 vertex is proportional to epsilon. So to get the epsilon term in the series, I need to draw all Feynman diagrams having 1 vertex. But we did that already. So unlike essentially all the other lectures I've given, this is mildly organized. Okay. So here is the vertex, 1 vertex, because it's proportional to epsilon. And all we need to do is to use these Feynman rules right here to evaluate that graph. So, okay, let me remind you, this is spiral learning. What is the symmetry number for that graph? Say it again?
There.
I'll go behind you.
Okay.
1 over 8.
1 over 8. Okay, so the symmetry number is 1 over 8. What is the... Now, there are two lines in this graph. So we need to write down the line contribution, which would be L2 squared. But what's a line?
1.
1. Okay, so we just write down 1. Okay, and we need to write down, here's 1 to 4 vertex,
whose value is... Yeah. Question.
Minus 24 epsilon.
Minus 24 epsilon. We put that in here. Minus 24 epsilon. We multiply this together, and there's only one graph having one vertex. That's it. We've drawn it. When you multiply this together, you get minus 3 epsilon. Okay? So there it is. Here is the minus, where is it? Here. Minus 3 epsilon. Okay? That's the minus 3 epsilon. Okay? Now, let's work out the next term. Next term in the series is supposed to be plus 105. I don't know if we'll be clever enough to evaluate that, but let's do that over here, actually. I think that's probably... So, I notice that this is epsilon squared, right? Epsilon squared. So this means we need two vertices, because there are two factors of epsilon. So we have to draw all the graphs having two vertices. So now, spiral learning. Let's begin again. Can you draw a picture of all the... Let's enumerate all the graphs having two vertices, with each vertex having four connections, because this is a V4. Okay, so what do you get? What's the... give me one example. Yeah?
This one?
The Mickey Mouse. The Mickey Mouse hat. Okay, so we have... I'll draw it like a Mickey Mouse hat. Okay, so that's a Mickey Mouse hat. Okay, so now we need to write down the symmetry number for that graph. We need to write down the contribution from the lines and the contribution from the vertices. Okay. So again, what is the symmetry number for this graph? 116. Okay, 116, which we worked out before. Now the line contribution. Now this graph has 1, 2, 3, 4 lines, so this should be L2 to the fourth power. But what's L2? This theory L2 is just 1, right? So this is just 1. Just multiply by 1. Okay. And there are two vertices. And each vertex is minus 24 epsilon. So altogether, we have minus 24 epsilon squared. OK. So if we multiply this out, looks to me like about 36 epsilon squared. Is that right? Take a 4 out of each of these, out of the 16, put it in here, about 36 epsilon squared. OK?
Times 4.
Hmm? Right? I take a 4 out of the 16, put it in here, make this a 6. Minus 6 times minus 6 is 36. Okay, good. Okay, that's the first graph. That's a contribution from the first graph. Next graph. There's more graphs. What's the next graph? What would you draw?
The one with 2.
The one with 2. Okay. So we have an infinity over here and an infinity over here, two infinities. OK, now we didn't work out the symmetry number for this graph. So what is the symmetry number for that guy? OK, so first we need the symmetry number, which is? Say it again.
1 over 8 for this graph and 1 over 8 for this graph, a little bit more.
I can exchange that. These are identical graphs. So remember, we can exchange those two graphs. So we get a factor of 1/2 because we can exchange those two graphs, right? So altogether, the symmetry number is 1 over 128, 1 over 64 times 2, 128. Times 1
times 20 times 1 times minus 24 epsilon squared, okay, which is, let's see, I could take an 8 and put it in here, and another 8 and put it in here, which would leave 1 half epsilon squared, and times 3 squared, which would be 9. Okay, so 9 halves epsilon squared. Okay? And now there's still one more graph, which is 4. Okay, so that's this thing that looks like this. And the symmetry number here is 1 over 48. Right? And that's multiplied by 1. There are 4 lines again. There are always 4 lines in this theory. Okay? Times minus 24 epsilon squared. So I think, what do I get? 12? Is that right? 12 epsilon squared. Okay? Okay? Do you all agree? I don't want to make an arithmetic mistake. Okay. So this is 36 epsilon squared. That's 9 halves epsilon squared. That's 12 epsilon squared. Now we have to add up the graphs, because according to our theorem, that was the sum of all graphs. And we have now added up the sum of all graphs having 2 vertices. So that's the part of the graphs that are proportional to epsilon squared. So if I put it over a common denominator of a half of 2, okay, so this is 72 halves, this is 9 halves, that's 24 halves, right? 72 and 24 is 96, and 9 is 105, right? So this is 105 halves epsilon squared, okay? 105 halves. And that is precisely this 105 halves, okay? That's how Feynman graphs work, right? That's how they work. Now, and clearly you could do this to higher order, and there are more graphs and so on. You notice it gets complicated. I mean, if I said to you now, draw all the graphs having 35 vertices, you would get, that would be an upsetting assignment. Okay, that would be a terrific amount of work. Why is that? Because the number of graphs is growing like n factorial, okay, in this theory. Grows roughly like n factorial. So this is very suited for quantum field theory, because in quantum field theory, nobody is going to evaluate a graph having 35 vertices. That's hopeless, okay? So that's why Feynman graphs are really wonderful, because they begin to get difficult just when it doesn't matter, because nobody in his right mind could evaluate the graph in the first place. Okay? But this is graph theory. This is it. The question is, why is this perturbation series? You see that the coefficients in this perturbation series are getting bigger and bigger very fast. And this is a divergent perturbation series. And you remember on Friday, I guess, I showed that this perturbation series grows like n factorial. Why is that? Because there are n factorial graphs. That's why. That's why it's getting very big. Okay. Now, before I quit, I just want to tell you what I did. And I wrote it down. Did I bring it? I think I did. On a piece of paper somewhere. So I got on the computer. And yeah, I did. I did bring it. Yeah. Okay. So I got on the computer and I took this perturbation series, which is divergent, and I padded it. Right? I mean, this is a divergent series. The question is quantum field theory useful? That is, when I calculate Feynman diagrams, is this a useful exercise? And I just want to show you what happened. Okay. So you remember the original problem. The original problem was to evaluate that integral. And I evaluated the integral I at epsilon equals 1. Okay, and the answer I got was 0.62028. Just doing it on a computer. Okay? Now, I took this perturbation series. This is a Feynman perturbation series, if you like, because it's a sum of graphs. Okay? And so Feynman deserves a lot of honor, a lot of respect here. And furthermore, I don't know if you guys know this, but have you ever read, Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman? And he talks about his high school teacher who was very inspiring to him. That was my uncle. Yes. Okay. So I calculated the pades, and so this is P00, and P11, and P22, and P33, and P44, evaluated at epsilon equals 1, P55, okay? And I also calculated P01, P12, P23, P34, P45, okay, to see what these pades give me. And the numbers I got were 1.838. Next one is 0.771. The next one is 0.732. Next one is 0.708. 0.690. Do you notice what's happening? The NN PADE sequence is monotone decreasing, and it's approaching the answer from above. You see that? It's monotone decreasing and approaching the answer from above. What about the N plus 1 PADEs? The first one is 0.250. Next one is 0.367, 0.435, 0.479, 0.509. And these pades are monotone increasing. These guys are monotone increasing from below. And the correct answer, which is 0.62, is trapped in between. And what's more, the pades are giving me an upper and a lower bound on the error. Okay? Now you understand, this is an amazing calculation. Why? Because I'm evaluating this at epsilon equals 1. This is not a small value of epsilon. In electrodynamics, the small value of epsilon is alpha, which is 1 over 137. And if we took epsilon to be 1% or something like that, 1 over 137, this would be accurate to about 5 decimal places. Or more, maybe 10 decimal places. Okay? But for epsilon very big, this is in the strong coupling regime where the coupling constant epsilon is big. It's of order 1. You notice that we're getting an answer that is between 0.69 and 0.51. This is 0.51, which is 0.62. Okay? And in fact, if we now process these numbers, because we know how to extrapolate, if you were to take the average of take the average of this and this, and the average of this and this, and the average of that and that, the average of this and this, and so on. That would be oscillating. You could then use Shanks, or, if you wanted, you could Richardson these numbers until you approach the limit, and you could Richardson these until you approach the limit. And just from this calculation, I can give you this number with a tremendous amount of accuracy. You might want to play with that. That's nice. Thing to do in that. Okay? So this, do you see what we did? In one lecture, I taught you Feynman diagrams. Okay? I showed you the symmetry number, which is the key element of Feynman diagrams. Okay? And we did a real field theory calculation in a very simple model field theory. And next time we'll do it in a more complicated field theory. Okay? But do you see where all of the elements of this course are fitting in? I mean, I hope the course is beginning to come together in your mind. I am showing you how to add up divergent series that result from the Feynman diagram calculations you have to do in really sophisticated mathematical physics. Okay? And it works.
getting the answer. Okay? Yeah.
So can we use this sort of PAD approximation to find out how a beta function evolves?
Absolutely. Sure. I mean, if you want to calculate a beta function in a quantum field theory, for example. So if you're doing, if you're studying, you know, renormalization group methods, things like that, if you want to calculate a beta function, that's a sum of Feynman diagrams. And indeed, if you want to know the beta function accurately, this is what you do. If you want to calculate a critical exponent, that's what you do. Yeah?
So does this PADE method erase the need for renormalization, or do you...
We haven't... Okay, so in this quantum field theory, you notice that every term, every graph in this quantum field theory is finite. If you have to renormalize, if you are working in four dimensions, the Feynman rules are more complicated, and we're going to talk about that. We're going to do this next time. Okay? And eventually, the Feynman rules get sufficiently complicated that the numerical value of the graph is always the product of the vertices times the lines times the symmetry number. Always. Always. But when you do that calculation for the vertices and the lines and so on, the vertices are usually not the difficult thing, but the lines, when you take the contribution of the lines, that may be infinity. So you have to renormalize. And when you get done, you will, renormalizing, you will now have each graph being finite. Okay? And when you add those finite parts of the graphs together, you will get a perturbation series, like this. Okay? And that perturbation series will be divergent. And then you will PADE that result. So post-renormalization. Renormalization is just a way of making a graph that doesn't seem to exist by Feynman's rules, making that graph, that particular graph, finite. And you have to make all the graphs finite. And renormalization theory says that with a finite number of steps, all of the graphs, your infinite number of graphs, will all turn out to be. If the theory is renormalized, okay, that's what you've learned. Yeah.
Sure. So to do this PADE table, then you'll have to figure out if you want to use the Feynman graphs until five, like the five vertex, until the five vertex graphs, right?
Yes. No. Up to the ten. I mean, because I used I calculated P55.
Right.
I evaluated this series
ten orders
up to epsilon to the 10. So I need epsilon to the 10th to get P55.
So that's factorial, 10 factorial
graphs. That's right, which I did. However, of course, I didn't do it by drawing all the graphs. I did it by expanding. Because I'm lazy. I mean, if you could evaluate a 10, if you could evaluate a graph having 10 vertices, you're good.
So this is a leftover question from last time. Because we have an analytic expression for the series as well.
Yes.
It's a divergent series.
And it's necessary that we do, because I want you to see how it works. You see, in quantum field theory, the problem with the way they give courses in quantum field theory is they say, evaluate the graphs, and here's the answer. They don't tell you that the answer is a divergent series. But also, they don't tell you what the answer had to be. So you don't know whether or not it's working.
So
but here you do know that it's working, because you saw the answer. You know the answer to begin with. And that's very important to understand what you're doing, to see that it works.
So could we have summed that series using Borel summation or something?
Yes. Okay. And in fact, if you sum, you're talking about this series right here.
The exact expression that we have.
Yes, because we know the formula for every
right,
term.
Right, so
of
we can
series.
Do Borel.
If we use Borel summation, you'll get that.
Oh, what?
That is precisely the Borel sum of that series. Okay, that's precisely the Borel sum. So if you do the Borel sum, that's another good exercise. Here's another exercise, which actually I recommend that you do. Do you remember, a long time ago, that I showed you how to calculate the roots of the polynomial, you know, x to the fifth plus x equals 1? Remember we looked at this? And you remember I said we could insert an epsilon over here at strong coupling extension. That would have been equivalent to putting an epsilon over here.
which is a strong coupling expansion. And this series is a convergent series, which you could work out instead of a divergent series. That's a convergent series. Okay? But then I said, remember I said we could put the epsilon over here, which is a weak coupling expansion, and that is equivalent to putting the epsilon over here in front of the highest power vector. And I showed you that the series began, I don't know if you remember, but the series began 1, I think it was minus 5 epsilon plus 35 epsilon squared, and so on. You notice? 1 minus something plus something. Exactly like this series. 1 minus something plus something bigger, and so on and so on. You notice? These numbers are quite similar. The series is quite similar. And this series is a divergent series. But now you know what to do. So it's a wonderful afternoon exercise. How about calculating a bunch of coefficients in the series? You know what the root is. Okay? You know the root. Okay? It's the root we're looking for is 0.755. Okay? You could Padé this series. This is a divergent series, but you could Padé it. And then you could find the show that the Padés are really converging to the right answer. So if you just try to sum the series, it's horrible. But if you Padé, then it works. You can calculate the roots. Okay? So this is really, I mean, you are now very, very powerful. You can now solve problems, okay, because you know the components of perturbation theory combined with summation theory. Okay, so maybe we should... I've run on a long time, but okay. Any further questions? No? Okay.
Yeah.